Morning, everybody. If we could all come in and get seated. As you notice, a bunch of the rows in the back are roped off. Not quite sure why, but it's probably dangerous to sit there right now. This morning, before we get started, a couple of housekeeping things. Again, don't forget to turn off your beepers and cell phones. And also, don't forget to turn in your evaluation forms. If you want credit, you need to have these evaluation forms turned in. And if you want your credit turned over to CE Broker automatically so you don't have to report it yourself, don't forget to put your medical license number in. This morning, it's my pleasure to introduce Anthony Lee, who is a vascular surgeon here at Boca Raton Regional Hospital. He went to Princeton University for his undergraduate and then to Johns Hopkins University for medical school. He did his surgery residency at the University of Michigan School of Medicine and then did a vascular fellowship at Stanford University. This morning, he's going to talk about peripheral vascular disease, which is obviously a topic that we all see. It's my pleasure.
Well, good morning, everyone. I woke up this morning with a little bit of headache, popped in some Motrin, and I think I'm pretty good to go. My biggest dilemma as I woke up this morning was to whether to come in dressed as scrubs, so you guys will know I'm a surgeon, or get fully attired with a tie, and I picked something in between and got to put a shirt on, and minus the tie. It's my privilege and honor to give this grand rounds today. I was invited by the program committee to give a similar talk on peripheral arterial disease or peripheral vascular disease a few years ago in this very setting. As I reviewed the previous talk, I thought about some of the messages I wanted to impart to this audience, and thought about what really changed in the last few years. And very little has. I mean, there are more clinical trials that's gone on in terms of a specific therapy and device that are device standpoint that's really kind of propelled by industry and secondary motives or objectives. But from a everyday management standpoint, in terms of what might be relevant, not so much to a specialist like myself, but to the frontline people, and I see, you know, there are medical students and residents here in the audience. Really, not much has changed in the last few years. So, as a way of frontline disclosure, if you will, I am not going to present to you in the next 45, 50 minutes a whole bunch of data with a bunch of p-values. What I want to tell you is some two or three or four, maybe even five if I get lucky, kind of clinical nuggets that I hope you guys take away as you leave this room today and apply it to your everyday practice. Even today, tomorrow, when you see new patients in the office or on the floor, and as you think about peripheral vascular disease. So I don't have any disclosures. So I want to start off, I'm not going to call on people, I don't know most of you guys, but I want to start off very quickly, and those of you who are not shy, raise hands or yell out with a few questions that really kind of are emblematic of some of the clinical scenarios that you guys may encounter in real life. So I'm going to read this out to you. So the first question is, a 79-year-old man who presents with right calf cramping at about 100 feet, relieved with rest, and on examination, he has a palpable right pedal pulse. So I'm going to give you three choices. The patient does not have vascular disease or vasculogenic claudication, may have vasculogenic claudication, and definitely has vasculogenic claudication. So what do you think? Any volunteers, students? One, two, or three? Yeah, two. Hopefully the reason why it's two will be elucidated during the talk. The second is, again, the same patient, 79-year-old, history of a variety of cardiovascular diseases, coronary artery disease, hypertension, six-month history of constant calf pain, constant. He's always complaining, whether it's sitting or standing. Numbness relieved, actually, with walking. It's not brought on by walking, but it's relieved with walking. His ABIs,
when you order them properly are 0.6. The first number is always the right leg, and 0.7, which is the left leg. Next step, as the clinician, should be, one, immediate referral to a vascular surgeon, immediate angiogram and intervention, initiate workup for possible non-vasculogenic etiologies of leg pain. Any volunteers? One, two, or three? Three, yes. Question number three, 79-year-old man. We're populated with 79-year-old people. One block thigh and calf claudication. The next diagnostic test should be ABIs with what's called an exercise stress test, arterial duplex ultrasound only without ABIs, which is frequently performed in this institution, or a diagnostic angiogram, the invasive study where you poke somebody's groin and shoot dye. One, correct. 79-year-old guy, another 79-year-old man, severe COPD, COPD, dyspnea and exertion, home oxygen, on chronic steroids for his pulmonary disease, typical Boca patient, ambulates 5 steps with a walker, barely on a good day, complaining of calf ankle swelling, redness, and pain. Arterial and venous leg Dopplers show no DVT, an SFA occlusion, an ABI, again, a 0.6 or 0.7. Treatment options may include all of the following except, it's one of these except questions, compression stockings for lymphedema or venous insufficiency, antibiotics for cellulitis, angioplasty and or stenting, or some kind of invasive intervention for SFA occlusion. Three. So, you know, for the last, probably for the last 20 years, and although it's getting better, vascular surgery has really suffered a crisis of identity. You know, when you talk to a normal, an everyday person, just, you know, it's like you ask him, and somebody asks you, what do you do? And you say you're a vascular surgeon. So, oh, you operate on the heart? No, we don't operate on the heart. So I thought we might start off by telling you what is the scope of our practice. So this this kind of idealized diagram of the arterial circulation and the venous circulation really illustrates where we go. And we get there either by using catheters or wires, which is usually termed endovascular, or open surgery, garden variety, cutting and sewing. And in the arterial system, you'll see the blacked out areas are where we don't go. But everywhere else we go. So we skip the heart, that's in the purview of cardiac surgeons. We skip the brain. Some neurovascular surgeons will treat blood vessel diseases of the brain itself. And usually we stay away from the hand itself. Up to the wrist we'll go, but anything beyond the wrist joint, we really leave it to hand specialists, which include either for plastic surgery or orthopedic surgery, because you really need microsurgery, surgical skills or techniques to deal with vascular issues involving the hand itself. And hand is such an important organ. And the same applies wherever there is an artery, there is an accompanying vein, and where the venous diseases, at least diseases that actually require intervention per se, are far less than arterial disease per se. And frequently when there are venous problems, we treat those as well in the similar areas. When one thinks about the broader term of so-called PVD, peripheral vascular disease, why anything outside of heart and possibly the brain is considered peripheral, if you will. But really, in the general vernacular, when we talk about peripheral vascular disease, you're really talking about lower extremity occlusive disease. That being said, from a specialty standpoint, some of the broad categories of disease states that we're called to treat are obviously aortic aneurysm, carotid stenosis to prevent stroke, and venous disease, which is entirely an entire symposium onto itself, but I'm not even going to touch upon these. And these are some representative examples of these disease states, and this is what we're really talking about and we're going to focus today. So before we go on, I think there is some merit in discussing lower extremity vasculature, because you will see that in radiologic reports that you order, whether it be invasive or non-invasive, whether it be a CT scan, MRI, or et cetera. So this is the aorta, which is cut off, and we're not going to talk about aortic disease. That's, again, a big field that you could devote an entire meeting to. But the aorta divides about the level of the belly button into two main arteries called the common iliac arteries. And let's just look at the right leg or the right side itself. So the common iliac artery once again bifurcates, and the theme of bifurcation, maybe because we're bipedal or we have a right. right and left side. The theme of bifurcation is present all over the vasculature. So it bifurcates once again into the internal or hypogastric artery. On this side of the Atlantic, the term hypogastric artery is more frequently used in clinical terminology than internal iliac artery. So the hypogastric artery and then into the external iliac artery. By every measure, one can say the hypogastric artery from a perfusion, organ perfusion standpoint is much more important, although less well known, than the external iliac artery. Simply because the hypogastric arteries, along with some of the other arteries that I'm going to go into, really perfuse end organs versus serving as what's called a conduit artery. Conduit arteries, and this theme once again is repetitive, as one thinks about the vasculature, are far less important physiologically than perfusion arteries, if you will. So this is the external iliac artery, and as it sneaks underneath the inguinal ligament, which is not shown in this illustration, it changes names into the so-called common femoral artery. The common femoral artery, once again, bifurcates into the deep femoral or the profunda femoris artery, which once again is so-called end organ perfusion vessel, and much more important than the superficial femoral artery, which, however, is more well-known and more frequently treated, than the deep femoral artery. And once again, this is a conduit artery, far less important than the deep femoral artery, to go into the popliteal artery, which actually is an extension of the superficial femoral artery, also known as SFA. The popliteal artery gives off so-called the trifurcation of the tibial vessels. So when vascular surgeons or radiological reports, you hear the word tibial vessels, they really refer to three principal arteries, two major and one minor. And the two major ones are the so-called anterior tibial artery and the posterior tibial artery, illustrated on the left leg here, but they're obviously mirror images. The peroneal artery is the lesser of the two, but in certain disease conditions, especially diabetics, the peroneal artery assumes a very important role, simply because in a lot of those, in many diabetics, the two principal arteries, the anterior tibial and posterior tibial arteries, are obliterated by the intrinsic disease, atherosclerotic disease, and the peroneal artery is interestingly spared and reconstitutes so-called the pedal vessels. Now, when people talk about pedal vessels, we've really gone away from the tibial vessels themselves and have gone beyond the ankle joint into the foot, intrinsic foot itself, and the anterior tibial artery changes names into the so-called dorsalis pedis artery, and the posterior tibial artery, however, as it curves around the medial malleolus of the foot, it maintains the same term, posterior tibial artery. So what is peripheral vascular disease? So one working definition is a progressive process of stenosis and acute on chronic, often PVD or PAD is a chronic process, typically from atherosclerosis, but it can rarely be from other inflammatory disorders in the major and medium-sized arteries. I specifically mentioned major and medium-sized arteries because when you talk about microvasculature, what is microvasculature to a vascular surgeon? It's a vessel usually 1.5 millimeters or less, and that is no longer surgically correctable. You might be able to do it with microsurgical techniques, but once again, that is rarely done. So about 1.5 millimeters, which is pretty small, but definitely doable from an intervention, whether it be surgical or endovascular standpoint. And this is a typical example of somebody with really end-stage peripheral vascular disease where you have dry gangrene and a couple of the toes here. So some of the lesion types that one sees in peripheral vascular disease are illustrated in these several bullet points. The lesions can be focal or very diffuse, and typically, I would say more often than not, atherosclerotic peripheral arterial disease lesions are diffuse versus focal. They can be stenotic or represent a so-called CTO or chronic total occlusion. The plaques can be quite calcific or quite soft, and they may represent intimal hypoplasia from a prior intervention or surgery where man has gone before, and this is a form of intravascular scar tissue, if you will. And in the setting of stenosis or in certain plaque compositions, it can result in acute thrombosis, or it can be embolic, such as cardioembolic phenomena. This is a fairly prevalent disease in the U.S. alone, and probably these numbers are slightly dated as the population ages and grows over decades. Probably within a couple of million, if you will, the prevalence is about 8 to 10 million people in the United States, representing up to one-fifth of adults in their seventh decade. And that being said, about 50% are silent, meaning you encounter. powder it. Let's say one is getting some kind of arteriographic study, whether it be a CT angiogram or even an invasive angiogram, one may know presence of lesions, atherosclerosis, some irregularities in the vasculature, but the patient is completely asymptomatic. And 25% have some type of symptoms, but clearly not classic symptoms that make one, as a clinician, one may need to question, is this coming from the vasculature, or could it be coming from the spinal cord, or some other etiology outside of vascular insufficiency, and those patients may or may not need to be treated at all. Therefore, if you do the math, 50% plus 25%, in the presence of peripheral vascular disease, up to 3/4 may require no intervention whatsoever from a vascular specialist. So one rule, one adage I strongly believe in after 17 years of practice is don't look for PVD. A lot of people do. Don't screen for it. Don't screen for it. Because without clinical presentation, silent PVD, I'm going to say this right now, it's one of the things, does not need to be treated. Spectrum of clinical peripheral vascular disease starts with claudication, and when we look at all comers that our clinic will present with some kind of clinical presentation or signs and symptoms, they typically present with, about a quarter of them present with claudication, and a smaller balance present with what's called CLI or critical limb ischemia. The natural history of critical limb ischemia, which really represents end stage or pre-amputation or limb loss conditions in peripheral vascular disease, is quite poor. When you look at the small subset of patients that do present with CLI, 25% despite treatment will lead to amputation. Obviously, there'll be an unsuccessful treatment. 25% will lead to some type of cardiovascular related death in 6 months. And you could see the different types of peripheral of arterial disease that can present with these types of symptoms. This is a classic example. This is a CT reconstruction of a CT. This is a post-reconstruction of a CT angiogram. And what you see here is a classic picture of isolated aorta iliac occlusive disease. You can see these are the renal arteries, and the entire infrarenal aorta is missing, as well as the common iliac and the external iliac arteries. And the infrainguinal circulation is pretty well preserved. This is an example of probably the most common presentation of peripheral vascular disease, where you have isolated SFA occlusive disease, and this patient would typically present with calf claudication per se. And this is an example of so-called multi-segmental disease, and when you look carefully, you have disease starting in the external iliac arteries, affecting the SFA as well as the tibial vessels. And when one sees a picture of this, one can expect the car presenting with some type of critical limb ischemia picture, such as tissue loss or rest pain. What are the risk factors of peripheral vascular disease? While this is clearly a disease of the elderly, other cardiovascular diseases are coexistent. Smoking, like every other cardiovascular disease, is a big risk factor. Diabetes, we talked about. Lipid management, hypertension, absence of antiplatelet therapy, not antiplatelet therapy, but absence of it, and sedentary lifestyle. I would consider some of these conditions not modifiable because, you know, if you are given, if you're genetically so inclined, even if you lead the healthiest lifestyle, you will get cardiovascular diseases. But the bottom bullet points are certainly modifiable, either through behavioral changes or medications, and that's where we certainly play a role. In medicine, there are many classification systems, regardless of what field you are in, and peripheral arterial disease, or PVD, is no exception. Over the years, two classification systems have really come to the fore, and depending on which discipline you come from, whether it be radiologic or surgical, you usually refer to one or two things when one talks about colleagues or in terms. But really, what we're really talking about for reporting purposes and when one conducts a formal study. So the first classification that has really come about is the so-called Fontaine classification. You may see this once in a while, and it ranges from stage 1 through 4, really correlating to the clinical presentation from asymptomatic peripheral arterial disease, which represents, once again, as a reminder, over 75% of the population. They would be considered so-called stage 1, Fontaine stage 1, to all the way to stage 4, which represents tissue loss or ulceration, which is the ultimate form of peripheral vascular disease. Dr. Rutherford, which is one of the early pioneers of peripheral vascular disease, came up with a classification system that really incorporates a grading along with a category system. It goes from grade zero, category zero, which again denotes an asymptomatic condition, to grade three, grade six, which represents tissue loss gangrene, which is equivalent to stage four Fontaine. So critical limb ischemia, representing end stage, it comes in two versions. One is restain, which is a lesser form of CLI, and somebody who presents with rest pain would be a Fontaine 3, which is equivalent to a Rutherford grade 2 category 4, or tissue loss, which would be a Fontaine 4, or Rutherford grade 3 categories 5 or 6, a typical example of wet gangrene. And you could almost see a pus swimming inside the plantar aspect. This, when one sees this, this is a surgical emergency, and that patient needs to go to the operating room right away. Over the years, almost concomitant with knowledge of peripheral vascular disease, different therapies have come about, and a consensus statement was formulated by multiple societies to engage in treatment of peripheral vascular disease, and put out some recommendations in terms of, can we guide everyday practitioners, vascular practitioners, I should say, in terms of what is the best modality to treat a certain disease condition. So I referred very briefly earlier that we can either treat diseases with endovascular catheter-based techniques or with garden variety open surgery with cutting and sewing. And what this consensus statement came out is, the more severe the lesion, the preferential route of treatment should be surgery. And for mild to moderate lesions, endovascular approach or the minimally invasive approach is probably preferable. So in terms of, and came out with so-called TASC classification, TASC, Transatlantic Interstitial Consensus Statement, and they came out with four lesion categories, the type A, type B, type C, type D. I'm not going to go into all the features of what makes a type B TASC lesion per se versus a type C, but suffice to say, briefly, these are some more focal and limited disease conditions, and this is more diffuse, or those that pertain to chronic occlusions versus stenosis. Some real-life examples of four types of lesions. This is a TASC A lesion, very focal lesion. This is the SFA. Those of you who may not recognize this, this is SFA going down the femur in the mid-thigh, typical location in the so-called adductor canal. Very focal, 1 centimeter lesion, may present with some mild to moderate claudication, and this is very easily treatable. And in 2016, when one sees a lesion like this, we would treat this endovascularly with a catheter, guide wire, angioplasty balloon, plus or minus a stent. Not everything requires a stent. Sometimes an angioplasty alone is more than adequate. This would be a TASC B lesion. Why? Well, it looks kind of focal, but you have a secondary lesion, a tandem lesion downstream. This would bump it up from a TASC A to a TASC B lesion. And why would this be a TASC B lesion? Because it's actually a foot. You see that there should be a continuity of this black line straight down, but instead you see this chunk of artery missing, and that would be a chronic total occlusion or a CTO, but it's fairly short segment. So instead of a TASC C, it would still be considered a TASC B lesion. And the real cutoff is actually 5 centimeters, so below 5 centimeters, you'll be a TASC B. This is an example. While you see a continuity of the dye going straight down the leg, but most people sitting in the audience can readily see that this segment is clearly abnormal compared to proximal distal segments, and this would bump it up to a TASC C lesion. And TASC B, which is the worst lesion, we could see diffuse collateralization from chronic occlusion and long segment occlusion of the artery proper. And patients who present with this type of scenario really should be shunted towards open surgery versus endovascular approach. So when one puts all of this together in the broad spectrum of so-called infra-inguinal peripheral arterial disease, one can use this kind of a table where with the Rutherford and Fontaine classifications back right on top of each other, which correlate from a clinical presentation standpoint, the expected AVIs and the TASC lesions, C and D. When you get to TASC C and D lesions, the clinical correlations, they usually present with CLI. So in terms of what one would expect, One working definition of intermittent claudication, or ICE, is reproducible pain, and it really has to be reproducible. If somebody says, well, I have this pain on Mondays and Wednesdays, but never Thursdays and Fridays, you have to be highly suspicious that something else is going on those days. So reproducible pain, that is pretty kind of crappy, but it doesn't necessarily have to be, and or fatigue correlated with exercise, whether it be walking, it could be walking uphill for certain people and never on flat ground, or walking versus not walking at all. When one presents with numbness, pain, paresthesias, and this is very important, not paresthesia anywhere, localized to the toes, especially the first toe, sometimes the fifth toe, but rarely in the middle toes, but usually most commonly in the first toe or the instep, which is the top of the dorsum of the foot, instep, and that is relieved with dependent position. And one hears that presentation. This is a classic description of what we call rest pain or the early stage of CLI, or peripheral limb ischemia. From a sign standpoint, the most frequent sign is not peripheral vascular disease. Once again, can be clinically silent. But as one progresses in the broad spectrum of peripheral vascular disease, what one is really looking at is mild muscle wasting, and that could be due to just chronic ischemia itself, and or from lack of exercise. When it hurts to exercise, then you're not going to walk, and your muscles are going to atrophy. Hair loss and shiny skin. For the medical students, when you walk into a room, when you're doing your outside rotations in urgent care or emergency room or in doctor's offices, if you're doing the rotations, when you see somebody with complete hair loss and they haven't gotten waxed or lasered in this set of population, you could be very sure that the patient has peripheral vascular disease. Why? The hair is the first thing from a nutrient supply standpoint, when you get peripheral vascular disease, you're going to lose. And you're going to lose the standard kind of turgor of the skin and kind of the dullness of what is normal in human skin. You get this shininess. You can almost look at your face. And dependent rubor. When one gets this from, this is reactive hyperemia from a physiologic standpoint. And when one sees this, it is not cellulitis. How do you tell dependent rubor from cellulitis? Well, you tell the patient to lay down, you lift the leg, and you raise them. You raise them, and within seconds, the rubor goes away. And you let it down, let the dangling, the rubor comes back. And when one sees that, when you see that kind of reactive hyperemia, that's peripheral vascular disease until proven otherwise. Coolness, power, obviously these, when you get to motor sensory changes, you're really looking at end stage and almost emergency type of situation where an urgent vascular consultation is required. Now, we'll switch gear from the clinical presentation with one you'd see a patient walking into the office to diagnostic studies. I want to go over what's called physiologic studies, and physiologic studies forms the cornerstone of diagnosis in vascular surgery. So the first step in diagnostics is the vascular lab. And like everything else, when you try to make an important clinical decision, you need good data. And garbage in, garbage out. That means the site where you're going to order these diagnostic testing should be accredited and validated. Not any Joe or Sally can do a proper vascular lab test. So how do you know when you're sending somebody to a facility to get a vascular test, how do you know that you're getting a good work product? Well, one type of so-called good housekeeping seal of approval in this arena is the ICAVL accreditation. And this, you'll see this seal or something similar to this on the reporting form. Any lab that has strived in terms of quality control and quality assurance to get an ICAVL accreditation will proudly display it on any reporting form that they have. Okay, and if you don't see it, you have to question about the validity of that lab. It is most important diagnostic tool, secondary drivers, a careful history, and maybe the only preoperative diagnostic test provided the data is valid, coming out of a validated vascular laboratory. That may be the only study that we need before we take a patient to a procedure room, whether the operating room or the vascular suite. What is the single most important study? The AVI, the resting AVI. And again, I'm going to drive this home, I said at the beginning of this grand round that I would like to impart 2, 3, 4, maybe 5, if I'm lucky, nuggets, clinical nuggets as you walk out of this auditorium. And if you don't remember anything else, if you suspect somebody who has peripheral vascular disease, please, please don't order anything else. Order this poor man's study called the ABI, ankle brachial index. And occasionally, if the lab allows it, Boca Raton Regional Hospital, we do have so-called segmental pressures that gives you an additional measure of pressure in terms of trying to localize what level is the actual occlusive disease. But that's not as important as ordering the ABI properly. There are many false negatives in terms of getting ABIs, and this is kind of the next order of analysis. And I'm not going to go into the whys or hows, but when we see, as vascular specialists, when we see an ABI, we really look at the number, the clinical scenario, as well as what we call waveform analysis. But you can get false negative due to decreased arterial compressibility. And some of those states include diabetes. Once again, diabetes is a bad player. Chronic kidney disease, and with rare conditions of isolated calcinosis. So what is an ABI, ankle brachial index? That's the acronym. And how do you obtain it? And you don't actually need a lab. One is dedicated enough. And back in the day, when some of us, we remember, we drew our own labs, you know, because we only had one lab draw a day and stuff, so we have to actually carry a tourniquet around, et cetera. You could actually do ABIs with a blood pressure cuff and a simple Doppler machine. And the way ABIs are done, you take high of the two ratios obtained by dividing the calf pressure required to occlude either the dorsalis penis artery, which is an extension of the anterior tibial artery, or the posterior tibial artery at the ankle level, by the higher of the two brachial pressures. So, in practice, this is one of the standard reporting sheets that you will get for an ABI, and you can see the technologist, or you, in this particular case, when a technologist is not available, what you're really looking at is you're going to get two brachial pressures, one in each arm, at all, and not infrequently, you will see the left brachial pressure being lower than the right because the occlusive disease of the left subclavian artery is not uncommon in this population. So typically, you'll get the right brachial pressure. And then these are segmental pressures, but if one orders just a single level ABI, the technologist will apply an appropriately sized tourniquet. That's a very important term, appropriately sized tourniquet. At the ankle, just above the ankle, and put a Doppler probe in two of the positions and get either the posterior tibial pressure in millimeters of mercury or the dorsalis pedis pressure. These are systolic pressures, and they will divide it. And in this particular case, in the right ankle, 155 posterior tibial artery, 154 dorsalis pedis artery, you pick 155. You take the higher of the two brachial pressures, which in this case is 121. It just coincidentally happens both, we're talking about the right side, but it's 155 divided by 121. You take a calculator out, it comes out 1.28, and that's what the ABI is. And normal ABI ranges from anywhere from 0.95 to 1.2, so the one would say this is. And in cases when we think this is a false negative or an inaccurate study, what we do is we actually do what's called a waveform analysis. I'm not going to go into that. It's beyond the scope of this talk, and that gives us another clue of how reliable this number is. So once again, when ABIs fail, we look at pulse volume importance or waveform analysis. Sometimes we'll look at total regulations, TBIs, and believe it or not, there are these tiny little, almost like toy-like blood pressure cuffs that can be applied to the big toe. The technologist will put a probe right at the tip of the big toe where the digital vessels are and obtain a total brachial index in that way. And the reason why we do that occasionally is some of the smaller digital vessels are spared the calcifications and not compressibility and other compliance issues that are that affect the pedal vessels. And so we'll occasionally get that, and some of the number ranges for that is a little bit different than ABIs. And occasionally, resting ABIs, depending on the location and the quality of the and the severity of the lesion, resting ABIs may be normal. Yet the patient complains very convincingly of vasculogenic claudication. And when you have that kind of a seemingly inconsistent picture, the way you sometimes uncover these so-called silent but clinically relevant lesions that may require intervention, is order what's called an exercise ABI. And even in the setting of a normal ABI, when you stress them on a treadmill, those lesions can be uncovered. The next, we've covered the physiologic study, so the next type of study we want to get when the physiologic study fits the clinical picture is an anatomic study. And once again, we rely on the vascular lab to do this. And that being said, if you're going to this, if you're not doing maintenance therapy as from somebody who has chronic PAD, but you're really thinking about as a frontline person, thinking about this patient may need an intervention, and this guy and this person may need a consultation with a vascular specialist. Don't order the anatomic study because depending on who you talk to, that particular anatomic study may be a non-invasive testing or may be invasive, depending on what it is. So once again, the first bullet point: do not order an anatomic study. You're going to consult vascular surgery. Optimal study depending on clinical presentation, as I said, and there are non-invasive options. Duplex ultrasound, which I mentioned in some of the questions I went over, don't order it as firsthand because that's an anatomic study, not a physiologic study. You always need to investigate the physiologic basis first. CT angiography has really come to the fore in the last 7 years as the technology has improved. MR angiogram, which is really pushed by this radiology department, and I don't agree with necessarily, I'm going to disclose that I have a strong bias against that. I really think CT angiogram is superior to MR angiography, provided you don't have a lot of equipment, such as allergy to contrast dye, chronic kidney disease, etc. When you take all of that out, if you have to choose in a normal patient, in a regular patient with that you want to investigate this, I would strongly counsel everybody to order a CT angiogram, not an MR angiogram. And last but not least is an invasive study, conventional angiography. So what are some of the benefits of non-invasive imaging versus invasive imaging such as conventional angiography? Optimal approach to lesion. Do we go through the left side, the right side? Do we actually go through the arm? Sometimes we intervene on the leg going through the arm when there's good, where there's no good access sites in the groins. Technical risk assessment. How many vessels are we talking about here? If the patient only has a single vessel runoff, you trash that due to a technical misadventure. You convert that patient from a claudicant, which is fairly benign, to a critical limb ischemia patient and stuff. Should this patient go to the endovascular route, or should we shunt them to an open surgical route, such as I referred to previously, from past A, B, or C or D lesions? And that being said, some of the limitations, I'm not going to go into this, but a lot of the non-invasive imaging is so-called flow-dependent. So when you have really diffuse disease, so-called diffuse multisegmental disease, what you're really looking at is downstream patency of blood vessels from a therapy standpoint may give you false negative results. So one has to take that into account. So contrast angiography, believe it or not, in 2016 still remains the so-called gold standard. A lot of negatives because it is invasive. Complications are associated with this, including contrast nephropathy. Depending on what study you read, anywhere from 1 to 8% contrast allergy or anaphylaxis in a smaller group of individuals, and puncture site-related complications, pseudoaneurysm, bleeding, hematomas, etc. At about 4 to 7%, again, depending on who you read. But it does allow simultaneous diagnosis and pathway-based intervention. This is standard standard angiogram of a normal arterial system here. So why are we talking about intervention? So what are we really talking about? Why are we doing this? Well, in this one study where one in a semi-quantitative scale, analog scale, of impact on one's quality of life. When one looks at this, you can see, although a scale of 0 to 100 in this particular analog scale, average well adult, I don't know how many scores are 55. I hope I'm actually score higher than that, but average well adult is 55. If you look at this, if you have even a mild migraine, that person would say their decrement in terms of their quality of life is almost 5-6 points lower than an average well adult. And where does intermittent claudication fit into this analog scale? All the way down here between congestive heart failure and chronic lung disease. So from a patient perception standpoint, a peripheral vascular disease, symptomatic peripheral vascular disease, let me re-emphasize, is a big quality of life issue. So treatments today, there is actually a medical treatment for peripheral vascular disease, surgery, endovascular, catheter-based, and what are our goals as an interventionalist? Improve quality of life, number one. We want to improve that, relieve pain, heal ischemic ulcers, and prevent limb loss ultimately. Medical management, risk factor modification, sedentary lifestyle, lipid management, antiplatelet therapy, et cetera. What are some of the drugs that really come to the limelight in the last 10, 15 years? Aspirin, obviously, that's like all, everybody can take an aspirin. Statins have really become important. Weight loss, Lassiterol. I put it there just for completeness sake, and I know a lot of practitioners put people on. I'm not a huge believer of Plateau, but I'm going to put it there in this presentation. Exercise therapy has really, there is scientific evidence of the benefits of exercise therapy. And if one talks about exercise therapy, this really has to be serious exercise. And what we're really talking about is not walking the dog for 10 minutes outside once in a while. What we're really talking about, minimum of 30 minutes of ambulation. This is for a standard clinician, at least 5 times a week, 6 times, 7 times, even better. An hour is better, but 30 minutes 5 times a week, and within 6 months, it's been shown to give 30 to 50% increase in walking distance for clinicians. And obviously, weight loss is a very important component. Surgery, bypass, or endarterectomy, when something is blocked, you want to go detour around or actually excavate it or core the lesion out, and that's what bypass and endarterectomy refers to. Salvage therapy occasionally when endovascular treatment fails or when you have unfavorable lesion types, as I referred to earlier in my talk. What are some of the pros? Well, surgery actually is very durable. We've been doing it for a very long time, and it lasts a long time, and it's very low cost. It costs nothing to take the vein out of your leg. It's your own vein, so you're not paying for it, and you pay for a few sutures and some operating room time. So what are some of the downsides? It's maximally invasive. You heard of the term minimal invasive, but it's maximally invasive. And some people, the conduits that we use, which are veins, some other surgeons have taken it, like the cardiac surgeon. So it's kind of a race to who gets the vein first. So endovascular is the next line of treatment, and this is and really there is a little bit of a dichotomy between so-called textbook literature or evidence-based, and we all like to pride ourselves. We practice evidence-based medicine, but I'll be the first one as an endovascular therapist. I'll be the first one to tell you that as much as I would like to pride myself as an evidence-based practitioner, that there is a little departure in terms of the real world versus what is recommended to be done. There's no question in 2016 when one sees clinically relevant or significant peripheral vascular disease, the first line treatment is endovascular. Some of the upsides is minimally invasive versus maximally invasive surgery. It can be frequently done as an outpatient, low morbidity, and rapid recovery. Actually, there is no recovery. There's hardly any recovery. When somebody gets a lower extremity angioplasty or stent, they go home that same day in the afternoon. I tell them to lay low that afternoon and that evening, and tomorrow they can go back on the golf course and try out their new wheels. Some of the downsides are durability and cost. These are expensive therapies, hugely expensive. I'm going to give you a little parade of medical gadgets and widgets that have really, an entire industry has propped up based on this therapy. And some of the favorable lesions, short stenotic, non-calcified, large vessel, good outflow, non-diabetic, and non-chronic kidney disease. I got to tell you, this is a zebra or unicorn in this area. So some of the tools and techniques you could see, I'm not going to go through all of this, but I'm just going to grab it. This is the old-fashioned angioplasty and stenting. Other techniques, the so-called subintimal angioplasty, we actually dissect the vessel on purpose because it creates a separate channel from the lesion. There are so-called cutting balloons. This is an example of a cutting balloon. If you guys look at this, I don't know how well it projects out there. This is actually an angioplasty balloon, and this is a 50 micron blade, standard blade. It's almost the thinness of a human hair that's actually mounted on the balloon. And these devices, obviously, there's a lot of technology. If you want to mount a blade, basically as sharp as a microphone, onto a balloon, there's a lot of technology involved, and there's a lot of R&D. So when you look at a balloon like this, I don't think anybody can hazard how much that costs. Okay? That's $1,800. $1,800 for single balloon, one-time use thing. And that's pretty cheap in this space, one device, $1,800. Cryoplasty, some people have thought that application of liquid nitrogen onto the lesion can slow down or even prevent intimal hyperplasia down the road. So cryoplasty had come into vogue about 10 years ago. I don't think many people do it. Laser has been around forever. People still do it. Directional atherectomy has really taken off in the last few years. These are extremely expensive devices. Drug-eluting stents came into the coronary field many years ago. It's finally coming to the peripheral vascular. And the newest and greatest that's recently starting to come out of the coronary side and trickles out to the peripheral side, we'll probably have access to vascular surgeons, probably in the next 5 years, is so-called now you see it, now you don't type of thing, where you have all the benefits of a stent, which is providing a metallic scaffold, and then over time, usually in anywhere from 2, 3, or 4 month time frame, the stent actually absorbs and disappears. So you don't have that foreign body reaction that can happen in terms of metallic stents. So these are some of the different types of stents. I'm not going to go into this. And they're bare metal stents. They're so-called covered stents. You can see how different these look. And and chronic total occlusions, when the vessel is not so much stenotic, but it's completely occluded, it really requires different types of techniques. And believe it or not, a 99.9999% stenosis is a completely a different animal from an interventional standpoint than 100% occlusion. One may say, what's a big deal? Well, it's a huge deal. From an interventional standpoint. So you need different types of tools. Again, I'm not going to go into all extremely expensive tools. And obviously, when you do any of these types of procedures, you're going to get into complications. And one of the dreaded complications is distal embolization. So the plaque that you're trying to treat actually has broken off and has traveled downstream and has plugged up the vital artery. What do you do then? Oh my God, call a surgeon. But I am the surgeon. So who am I going to call? So I can't call myself. I'm already there. I like to call my partner, Dr. Mata, but he probably won't take that too kindly. So you have to have other tools to get yourself out of trouble. There's a whole field of aspiration and thrombus management tools that, again, I'm not going to go into. So some of the challenges to SFA, and I'm going to pick SFA simply because it is a most commonly treated segment, and occlusions are more common. There are issues of motion artifacts here, so-called flexion work that can really introduce fatigue to stents and lead stent fractures, and there's frequently associated outflow disease. And I'm going to give you some real-life examples of interventions, and you could see in this particular composite picture, you can see the SFA and popliteal segments are relatively well-preserved, although diffusely diseased, and you could see isolated tibial disease. This is a diabetic, 66-year-old diabetic with end-stage renal failure who applies standard interventional techniques. After use angioplasty disc with a 3-millimeter balloon, you can see a straight line flow where compared to this one. Another example here, one can readily see that this is the external iliac artery, the profunda femoris or the deep femoral, and what is missing here is the SFA. This is a long segment occlusion with reconstitution of the above the popliteal artery using standard techniques. And this is what's called a re-entry catheter after we do what's called a subintimal dissection, and we restore a straight line flow here. You can see a dark line here, absence of dark line here. And another example of isolated tibial disease presenting with tissue loss, you can see the popliteal artery. This is the so-called trafication. We're at the below knee level. You can see the peroneal artery relatively spared, but the anterior tibial and posterior tibial arteries are gone, and using standard interventional techniques, we restore both flows to salvage the foot. So basically our motto is where the wire will go, we will go. And you can see this is an example of the low knee segment. This is the anterior tibial artery. You can see how diffusely diseased, and due to the multitude of collaterals, you can see the chronicity of this process. All the other tibial vessels are gone. The patient had a toe lesion, so we needed to get straight line flow. Again, this is a chronic total occlusion. You don't see all of these squiggly lines are collaterals. They do not represent the main artery that we need to open. Using standard techniques, you could see the wire going all the way to the foot. This is the ankle joint here. This is the top of the foot right here. The wire is all the way going down, almost to the level of the toes. Using a standard balloon, we restore a straight line flow here, and you can see where, compared to this and this, the patient ends up with a palpable pulse. So I'll wrap up here. So in terms of peripheral vascular disease management, clinical presentation, once again, clinical presentation, absolutely key. Do not look for it. Do not treat asymptomatic disease. If you don't remember anything else, please remember that. You have symptoms. No, you just have incidental finding of peripheral vascular disease. Expected management only. If they do have symptoms, and you get the symptoms from the careful HMP, obviously.
I do want to go over that algorithm because that is, and else. So anyway,
So if they do have symptoms, the first line of diagnostics is obtain a physiologic study, and once again, use a vascular lab, and make sure, again, the concept of garbage in, garbage out, and make sure you order a test from an accredited lab, and if the physiology does not fit with the symptoms, you have to go into your differential diagnostic list. I mean, the list of things that can cause so-called leg pain, as convincing or classic it is, stretches this long. Only one line item is vasculogenic claudication, or you can just say, well, we can't figure it out, but it's not vascular, and you don't have anything else wrong, so I'm sorry, you've got to kind of live with it. So expect a management. However, if physiology fits with the symptoms, the next order of testing is anatomic testing. And when you get to this level, as a clinician, what you want to do is you seriously want to think about getting vascular surgical consultation. And once again, we will determine what the proper anatomic study is. And if the anatomy doesn't fit with the physiology, then we have to go back to the drawing board and think of that, scratch our heads and try to determine what really is the problem. However, when the anatomy fits the physiology and the physiology fits the symptoms, the final pathway it leads to is an intervention. So anyway, I'll just finish up with that. Thank you for your attention.
Any questions? Yes, sir.
Can you comment on the aspirin dose, high dose, low dose? Did you see people doing all kinds of things, but I was always taught that low dose for cardiac and high dose for anything else?
No, I think low dose is 81 milligrams is more than adequate.
What do you have to use for plastic dose and how long?
You know, the data behind that is extremely, 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 extremely non-existent. However, the standard practice is 1 month, 1 month of Plavix with full dose of aspirin. That's 81, but in this case, 3.5 for 1 month and 325 milligrams of aspirin in perpetuity.
Your
adage
not to treat asymptomatic disease.
Peripheral vascular, yes.
Is a little bit contrary to my primary care motive of trying to treat medical disease before critical limb ischemia. So, can I use
I think that's great. I'm sorry if a little bit of that emphasis was a little bit tongue-in-cheek, but I think from a maintenance therapy or risk stratification, which I think is what, by all means, if you want to kind of risk stratify their cardiovascular status for lipid management, et cetera, yeah, by all means, you could go ahead as a screening tool. I really meant that from an intervention standpoint. Make no mistake, this is a money-making business for everybody, for industry, for practitioners. And, this is not the message I wanted to impart to everybody here, whether they're vascular practitioners or